hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the car of God's key. If you don't love it, lead it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight beside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a far dark. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fog that I keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. With lots more news and views for our people, and of course those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening, you know, this morning in the European heartland. Well, lots to talk about today. Might not be too surprising, but once you give in to the cultural wreckers, the sky is the limit. I'll tell you what happened. Just as in the United States, where there's this orgy of demands for the removal of Confederate statues, and in fact, that's what the confrontation in Charlottesville 2 weekends ago was all about, the announcement by the Jewish mayor of that city that the city's intention to take down the monument to the great general of the Confederacy, Robert E. Lee, who of course was also a Virginian. Well, up here in the Dominion of Canada, similar pressures from some of our Indians wanted one of the buildings or wings of the House of Commons called the Langevin block renamed, because Langevin, who was a French lieutenant or Quebec lieutenant to Canada's first prime minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, he supported the idea of residential schools. Well, now that's today politically incorrect. And, you know, it's an unfair knock. History is history, and important personalities are important personalities, often for reasons that escape the politically correct. Langevin was an important politician at the time of Confederation and the first 20 or 30 years of our existence. Things, some of the things he did by today's standards might be controversial. But what was this residential school stuff that that so has the Native Indian activists up in arms? Well, it was the fact that in remote areas, not all areas, but in remote areas, beginning in 1885, the Dominion government, which was responsible for education of the Native people, unlike other people, the responsibility was provincial, but the Dominion government had particular responsibility for Indians. So what they did was they gathered Indians together. They would take them from the reserves, from their parents, for about 9 months of each year, and they would be housed in residential schools, as in a residence. And there they were given an education, trying to give them the rudiments of reading, writing, and mathematics, and maybe a little bit of industrial arts, as they used to call it, which would be perhaps woodworking or machine, home economics for the girls, maybe a little bit of science, a little bit of history and religion, and they would be returned to the reserves in the summer. Now, this has been of recent years the cause of all sorts of boo-hoo-hooing and breastfeeding and guilt-mongering and so on. Oh, it was trying to take their culture away. Oh, it was so bad being removed from their families. Well, a little bit of a reality check. Number one, many white kids were removed from their families if they were well enough off to go to residential private schools, to boarding schools. Why? Because fairly remote areas, there wasn't the population for, let's say, a high school. So, to get the sort of education that might at least possibly lead on to university, in many parts of rural Ontario, and more so in the Canadian West, it was necessary to send the young persons away. If they were lucky, they might be sent to an aunt or uncle in a big city or town, but if not, they would be sent to a boarding school. Well, life in a boarding school might have some good points, but it would also be lonely. It'd be lonely, separated from your family, and so on. We can recognize that. But it wasn't a diabolical plot. Furthermore, the Dominion government, beginning in 1885, faced a big problem. And that problem was, what do we do with the Native people, with the Indians? Now, where they were in larger numbers, there might already be some education, often provided by churches. But in more remote areas, what do you do with them? Do you simply leave them to their own devices? That's kind of benign neglect. And say, oh, well, if they can somehow, the tribe can somehow put together a school, even a one-room schoolhouse, good. If not, oh, well, too bad. Yep. And the big challenge was, how do you move people from Stone Age, wandering, largely nomadic people, without even a written language? How do you move them from Stone Age to the edge of the modern age? Or do you even want to? That question, of course, is never answered today. The Dominion government could have simply taken the rude, benign neglect. Hey, whatever. They have the same right to organize an education for their children as other Canadians. I won't take any special interest in them, but they didn't. They set up these residential schools, mostly staffed by the Catholic religious orders or Protestant clergy and lay ministers. They chose the latter. I think it was still the right choice, but modern political correctees does not. Anyway, because he was a supporter of that, Hector Langevin, a lieutenant to Sir John A. Macdonald, he has come under the naming of this government wing after him, has come under fire from the history wreckers. Unfortunately, the trust fund kid, our prime minister, gave into that. Well, now, of course, there are more demands. The most recent I'll come to this in a moment. There's the demand that the statue of Lord Cornwallis be torn down in Halifax. Now, Lord Cornwallis was important, not only for his actions in the American Revolution some 20 years later, but he founded Halifax in 1749. He's the founder of the city. So you're going to tear down his monument? Why? Well, I'll get to that in a moment, but the short answer is, well, he issued a bounty for Indian scalp, Mi'kmaq, or Indian tribe in that area, Nova Scotia. He issued a bounty for their scalps. Now, was this genocide? Well, no, they'd been massacring some of the English settlers. It was warfare, it was tit for tat. I'm going to give some more background on that in a few moments. Well, even more recently as 2 days ago, at a meeting of the Ontario Elementary Schools Teachers Association, a motion was put forth and passed that the names of schools named after our first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, be renamed. So they want to get rid of our first Prime Minister. Now, granted, it's not in their power, but nonetheless, this is an idea being put out there. Fortunately, at least thus far, it's been mostly rejected. Now, Sir John A. Macdonald, what's the knock against him? Well, he had a low opinion of Chinese people. And it was on his watch that the residential schools were brought in. Oh, that makes him, well, you know, the big R word, that makes him a racist. Whether it would make him that, in the opinion, by today's skewed morality, maybe so, maybe not. But at the time, his views were mainstream. So do we rewrite history and purge it of anybody who would not meet today's standards? It doesn't matter whether they made a contribution, or perhaps maybe even built the edifice or the institution. And that's the battle I think sane people and traditionalist people are having to face. Well, back to the issue of Lord Cornwallis. And that's a very interesting article by Peter Sean Taylor, who is editor at large of Maclean's magazine. He calls it a Canadian crisis of conscience. For his role defending the notion of slavery, statues of Confederate General Robert E. Lee come toppling down across the United States. Slavery, it is often considered America's original sin, and such sinners, we're told, have no place in our modern world. There's a little poster I put up. It's not my own doing, but it shows an American dollar bill, and it says, if you look at the 1, 5, 10, 20, and I think $100 U.S. bill, all of them commemorate slave owners. Please boycott them and send them to me for disposal. And it's true. I mean, slave owners were an important part in the early years of the United States. And what's also important, though, is as America evolved, slavery was abolished. Do we purge out the memory of anybody who, prior to 1863? Anyway, back to Peter Sean Taylor's article. Penn is also experiencing a crisis of historical conscience, most notably in Halifax, where a statue of Edward Cornwallis is in peril of a similar fate and for an equally ugly past. In 1749, shortly after disembarking as governor of Nova Scotia and founder of the first British settlement at Halifax, Cornwallis blundered into a nasty fight with neighboring Mi'kmaq tribes. In response to their initial attacks, Cornwallis issued a now infamous proclamation stating that his nascent colony would pay, quote, a reward of 10 guineas for every Indian Mi'kmaq taken or killed, to be paid upon producing such savage taken or his scalp. The reward was good for men, women, and children. This was a form of all-out warfare. So it was a 10 guinea, which would be 1 pound, 1 shilling. So that would be roughly 11 pounds, which would be a pretty princely sum of money for each Mi'kmaq either captured or killed, and that would be evidenced by producing his scalp. Cornwallis' scalp bounty has become the key piece of evidence in the case for removing his statue from downtown Halifax. Such a proclamation, critics such as Mi'kmaq author Daniel Paul claim, is proof, quote, of his attempt to exterminate a race of people using barbarism. Surely someone who paid cash for the scalps of dead natives has no place in the public square of a Canadian city. However, as the author Peter Sean Taylor continues, yet there's more to Cornwallis' story than the seemingly black-hearted action of one villain. While there's no debating the horrific nature of his scalp bounty, or how it conflicts with current Canadian sensibilities, scalping for profit was once common practice throughout this country. And he'll go on to say, and not just among whites. And unlike slavery, it was embraced by all parties. He's wrong about that. Slavery in the United States, there were blacks who owned slaves, and probably the first slave owner in the United States, other than Native Indians, was black. And many Indian tribes owned slaves who had been captured when they were defeated. Recent academic research shows both British and French colonial governments paid for scalps long before Cornwallis landed in Halifax. And many indigenous peoples, that's the Indians, were lifting the hairs, another way of saying scalping, of their enemies for centuries before that. If scalping is Canada's original sin, then everyone's a sinner. And that's an interesting point. The question of who invented scalping was once hotly debated. During the 1970s, Native activists and sympathetic white liberals often claimed scalping was a European invention imposed by rapacious colonialists. Indians, quote, Indians fought each other for 1,000 years and never took scalps, Hollywood actor Iron Eyes Cody told the Washington Post in 1976. Such an argument found traction in popular pop culture and academia, and still kicks around the internet today. But while a great many atrocities can be laid at the feet of Canada's European ancestors, scalping is not one of them. On his second voyage up the St. Lawrence River in 1535, French explorer Jacques Cartier noticed, quote, the skins of 5 men's heads stretched on hoops, like parchment, in native camps. Archaeological evidence also reveals telltale scoring on pre-contact era skulls that could only have come from stone knives. Even linguistics points to scalping as a uniquely indigenous custom. It's Native Indian custom. While early explorers such as Cartier and Samuel de Champlain struggled to find appropriate words to describe this practice, Champlain used the term head leathers. Many native languages had specialized expressions for the act and its victims. Not until 1676 did the verb to scalp gain its unsettling present-day meaning in English. So, to make a long story short, Indians were scalping each other centuries before the first white man appeared in North America. Indigenous scalping served several purposes, says Jean-François Lozier, a historian at the University of Ottawa. Many indigenous groups conceived of the top of the head as the locus of the soul or spiritual power, Lozier explains. Taking a scalp was a way to deprive a victim of the ability to haunt you from another world. So the base superstition. As proof of death, scalps were very practical war trophies. It's a lot easier, he quote, it's a lot easier to travel back home with just the hair of your victim rather than the whole head, says Lozier. However, he adds, it was always the goal of indigenous warriors to bring back prisoners who might be assimilated through adoption into the tribe, primarily women and children. Male prisoners were often tortured to death in grotesque fashion. This is also largely flushed down the memory hole. The native people were incredibly brutal to one another and to anybody unfortunate enough to be captured by them. This doesn't mean today's natives should be blamed for the actions of their ancestors, but come on, fair is fair. Let's not demonize white people today for practices that that were commonplace among Native Indians up until well into the 19th century. And the article by Peter Sean Taylor continues. Early European explorers initially reacted with horror at these Canadian traditions, but eventually both British and French colonial officials accepted head leathers, or scalps, as a useful and intimidating military practice. And in typical European fashion, they added an economic angle, payment upon delivery. Puritans in New England were the first to offer scalp bounties in 1637. 40 years later, Connecticut established 20 cloth coats as the going rate. By 1703, it was £40, which would be a lot of money. The English tended to view scalp bounties in a transactional manner, said Lozier. Bounties appeared during wartime to encourage greater military participation. When war was going poorly, the rates could hit £100 for a scalp. In Canada, scalp bounties were first introduced in 1691 by New France governor, the Comte de Frontenac. While English colonies typically paid bounties to white military volunteers for native scalps, the French tended to pay native warriors for the procurement of white English scalps. So scalping was done, unfortunately, and somewhat embarrassingly, by white people of other white people. So let's not lay this all at the feet of Lord Cornwallis. In Canada, also, unlike the English, the French rate was stable, permanent, and meant as a subsidy to maintaining native loyalty. Provided in form of trade goods, it was the equivalent to about 4 months' salary for bringing in a scalp. Scalping for profit in Canada reached its zenith in the Seven Years' War, which was 1756 to 1763, when France and Britain battled for control of the continent by any means possible. Afterwards, the practice became less common, although it continued throughout the American Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. In the American West, scalp bounties remained a grim feature until the late 1800s. Given this context, perhaps Cornwallis deserves to be seen not as an isolated example of a horrific practice, but rather as one of its most easily identified practitioners. Thanks to his current-day critics, the text of his lamentable declaration can be found instantly via Google. On the other hand, Lozier's important work on the proliferation of scalp bounties throughout colonial-era Canada is available only through a French-language academic journal. While his actions were once considered standard military procedure and widely accepted across all early North American societies, Cornwallis has lost the battle, the modern battle of reputation, because it's being presented in an unfair way. I know it may not be a strong moral argument, but everybody's doing it. Happened to be the truth. It was standard practice by the Indians against other Indians, by the Indians against whites, and by both the French and the English against other whites, as well as Indians. So no, Lord Cornwallis's bounty, so to speak, was not some unique attempt to exterminate the Mi'kmaq people, and nor did it have that effect at all. It was an act of war against people who had made war on the British settlers. That's the reality, and it's important. And we're going to have to do a lot more of this in trying to claw back our country from the revolutionaries. Oh yes, the transgendered. Now, so much fuss is made about these people. And in fact, CAFE, that's the group I head, the Canadian Association for Free Expression, is seeking to intervene in a transgendered case in Vancouver. A transgendered creature named OJ has filed a complaint against a good friend of mine, Bill Watcott, who's a Christian preacher, and who handed out literature in the last provincial election where OJ was up front running as a transgendered. In fact, it was put about that he might well be the first if he was elected, and there was a good chance he could be elected. In the end, he wasn't, but there was a good chance he could have been. He could be the first transgendered elected, I think it was in British Columbia, although it might well have been in all of Canada. Anyway, OJ has filed a complaint against Mr. Watcott for handing out literature, criticizing him as unfit for office because he believed he was born a male and now believes he's a female. And Mr. Watcott felt that was both religiously wrong, sinful, sign of mental instability. Anyway, I'll be coming back to that on another occasion. We just submitted submitted a response to objections the prosecution. That's OJ to our request to intervene. CAFE wants to intervene on behalf of Mr. Watcott and stick up for free speech. Anyway, what's the big breakthrough today? Well, with all our immigration problems, starting at the end of this month, transgendered Canadians can indicate on their passports that they don't identify as either male or female. They just bloody well don't know what they are. Hey, I'm mentally unbalanced. Yesterday I was Paul. Today I kind of think I'm Napoleon. You better call me Emperor. Anyway, it's the latest step in the federal government's plan to eventually allow individuals to identify their sex as X. That is unspecified. That is damned if I know. On passports and other government-issued documents that typically allow people to tick only M for male or F for female. Until documents with an X option can be printed, the government will allow people, starting Thursday, to add an observation to their passport stating that their gender should be identified as X. Immigration Minister Ahmed Hassan, there's Ahmed. Ahmed, he's a Somali Muslim. He was a self refugee. He was the head of the Canadian Somali Association. He's an immigration lawyer. Yeah, this is the dude who's supposedly guarding our gates. Well, okay, he's doing nothing. They pour across, the illegals pour across the border from New York State into Quebec. Over 7,000 since the beginning of July. It's out of control. Hassan, you can't do anything about that. No, they're monitoring the situation. I will come back to that. But anyway, they're monitoring. What does that mean? It means they're sitting on their rear ends, scratching their bums and doing nothing. Anyway, according to Ahmed Hassan, his department, this will be the first to introduce the interim measure, part of a government-wide initiative to make all government-issued documents gender-neutral. They don't know what they are. The initiative stems from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's promise to better reflect the gender diversity of Canadians. Quote, we are taking an important step toward advancing equality for all Canadians regardless of gender identity or expression, Hussein said in a statement Thursday. Oh yeah, very important. That's pretty important. You know what? I would hope that there will be countries where if you show up with X on your passport, they quite rightly look at you and say, you're messed up. You're mentally unbalanced. You don't know whether you're male or female. Well, we're not going to figure it out. And we don't want you, if you're that unstable, we don't want you here. On the plane, go home. And that's what I think ought to be done. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes with more news and views for our people. And I'm going to play a song here. I hope you like this. And this is a song with Merle Haggard, although it's really Gretchen Wilson, another girl with a lot of good attitude. And she gets an assist in this from Merle Haggard. And this is called Politically Uncorrect, Gretchen Wilson. Well, once we can suppress this ad.
Must come down.
A trip to the grocery store or a tank of gas.
That's the family farm that's been in the family for over 100 years being sold.
Are you concerned about the violence and the death?
Seems like I have, less money to spend on
another deadly day in Iraq is 11 U.S. soldiers.
I'm for the low man on the totem pole, and I'm for the underdog, God bless his soul, and I'm for the guys still pulling third shift, and the single mom raising her kids, and I'm for the preachers who stay on their knees.
Gretchen Wilson with an assist from Merle Haggard. politically incorrect. Now, here's one that, this is, I think, her first big song, Gretchen Wilson and Redneck Woman. Gretchen Wilson and Redneck Woman. That's really was her. That was kind of her debut song. I'll play one more song here for our musical interlude, and in honor of the ongoing battle for the Confederate monuments against the Wrecking Crew. This is Rebel Sun, Bury Me in Southern Ground. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me. Thank you.
morning, come sit by me right here. Let's laugh and talk about our lives and the good old days before I die. Please give your word this vow you keep. When I return to earth to sleep, let me dream forever on a southern land with a Dixie flag tied in my hand. Before I close my weary eyes, southern air for my last breath, here comes my sweet angel of death. Sing Dixie while they lower me, so I'll hear it for eternity. I can feel the reaper's touch, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Dixieland is where I want to make my final stand. I don't care if I'm in a box or not, when they lay me down, just bury me in southern ground.
And that's Rebel Sun, Bury Me in Southern Ground. And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. This is an interesting article. Always interesting material written by a good friend of mine out there in British Columbia, Tim Murray. Who needs a functional refugee policy in a borderless world? And this was a tweet from our trust fund kid, the Prime Minister, earlier this year. To those fleeing persecution, terror, and war, Canada will welcome you regardless of your faith. Diversity is our strength. So much concentrated garbage in 140 characters. This was made in response to President Trump's first executive order banning entry into the United States to Muslims coming from, I believe the first one was seven different countries. It made a lot of sense, actually. But not to the trust fund Kim. He wanted to signal virtue. Well, a lot of people, including Haitians, took him at his word and thought that that's a good idea. This country is run by fools and is open, and they have streamed up illegally ever since. Anyway, Tim Murray says, no doubt you've seen images of some of the more than 10,000 illegals who streamed illegally into Canada from the United States at unofficial border crossings. That is, that they don't go through the regular crossing. They sneak in. For the most part, in Manitoba and Quebec. What began as a trickle 8 months ago has become a flood in August. The city of Montreal reported that while there were 50 per day in the first half of July, there are now between 250 and 300 illegally crossing now in August. The sheer logistics of processing, transporting, sheltering, and feeding this latest surge of border jumpers has overwhelmed the limited resources of the Canada Border Services Agency, or the CBSA. And the RCMP is pitching in too, smiling at migrants as they help them with their luggage. It seems that this fabled law enforcement agency has become an extension of the hospitality industry, a collection of bellhops and Walmart greeters. Or are they the public relations arm of the globalist government in Ottawa? Perhaps they should be wearing their ceremonial red serge uniforms as they chaperone illegals. I mean, it is a disgrace. And just today, I wrote an angry note to the ticket police in one of the counties in eastern Ontario. I got a speeding ticket about a year ago, and I fought it. I lost. And what I've said to them is, you know, I get treated rudely. I get an unsigned, that's right, unsigned, threatening letter. We can take away your license, blah, 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 if you don't send your money in. And I said to them, you know, if I were an illegal, that's right, if I were an illegal from Haiti, I'd have the cops, instead of trying to collect some revenue from me, would be facilitating my entry into the country. That's right. Facilitating my entry into the country, carrying me up my suitcase, perhaps even giving me a cup of coffee. Oh, how nice. So you break the law and the cops facilitate it. You're invading my country. However, as a citizen of this country, and on my mother's side, we've been in this country for 350 years, all you get is insolent harassment. Anyway, back to this article. Amid the chaos, says Tim Murray, makeshift shelters are being constructed and initial screening and vetting checks postponed because of the swell of refugee claims. The basic background check that would normally take 72 hours to complete will now take 2 months. Will Canada mimic Europe, overwhelmed by mass migration and the problems that ensue from it? The signs are ominous. The ship of state is drifting, and there's a flake at the helm. Yes, that's our Prime Minister, the trust fund kid. The crisis caught authorities by surprise, but it shouldn't have. When President Trump mused about suspending the temporary protected status, or TPS, for 60,000 Haitians, one would have thought that one could have expected that they would make a mad dash to the candy store up north. Well, yes, of course, there are a lot of Haitians in Montreal. Duh! Especially when they got a personal invitation from the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, always anxious to play the role of the white knight of generosity and compassion with my country and our money. His Twitter message was, regardless of who you are or where you came from, there's always a place in Canada for you. Come on in. And the nonsense about diversity is our strength. No, diversity is chaos. Trudeau's hypocrisy was breathtaking. When the media failed to notice that Canada had a temporary program for displaced Haitians, Haitian quake refugees, on its own, but it was wound down in August of 2016 under Trudeau's watch. So instead of telling Haitian asylum seekers the truth, that the government was unprepared to receive them, the Prime Minister chose to grandstand, to contrast himself to the evil Trump. He was going to drive the welcome wagon and set up impromptu welcome stations along the border. The claimants would be bused to Montreal, one of Canada's 10 self-styled sanctuary cities. Yes, Canada has them too. what columnist Daniel Greenfield called the coalition of the self-righteous. Renegade city councils voted to permit illegal migrants to receive housing, avail themselves of food banks, libraries, and other services with no questions asked about their immigration status. In other words, enabling crime. In sane times, it would be unthinkable for the most junior level of government to refuse to cooperate with federal law enforcement officials. But these are not sane times. Instead, city law enforcement agencies have been ordered not to apprehend undocumented immigrants. That didn't mean they kind of left their documents on the dresser this morning. It means they don't have any. They are illegal. One gains the impression that the Trudeau administration is not terribly upset with this arrangement. Taxpayers, however, have a different view. It should not come as a shock that 41% of Canadians polled by the Angus Reid Institute supported the statement that Canada is taking in too many refugees. And a Reuters poll conducted on March 8th to 9th found that all but 36% of respondents believe that those illegally crossing the border should not be allowed to remain in the country. Duh, right. So, I would phrase that a little differently. 64% believe that those who enter illegally should have their sorry, dusky butts booted out. Rightly so. The Canadians are not in love with the idea of the queue jumpers who bypass official border crossings to do an end run around the Canada-US Safe Third Country Agreement can just walk into the country, declare they're seeking refugee status, and while in limbo, apply for work permits and receive social assistance. Simply put, the ongoing invasion is trying their patience. No wonder. Former Deputy Immigration Minister John Mannion once estimated that refugee claimant expenditures alone cost Canadian taxpayers about $2 billion. That's just the refugee expenditures. It's bad business. Well, it's a good business for immigration lawyers and various other system parasites, but not very good for the Canadian taxpayer. And it doesn't help when many deportation cases become mired in extended legal battles in the courts. But as costly as this proves to be, deportation is a bargain compared to the annual $30 to $35 billion net fiscal burden that largely unskilled migrant citizens impose on other Canadians. That's a calculation by former member of parliament, former reform member of parliament, and professor of economics at Simon Fraser University, Dr. Herb Grubel. That's the net cost of our largely unskilled, poorly screened immigration is $30 to $35 billion a year. That is, what do the he arrived at that figure by looking at what they contribute to the tax pot at all levels. Income tax, sales tax, etc. And what they take out. And the conclusion? They take out $30 to $35 billion a year more than they put in. Immigration is our greatest strength. Bollocks. Nonsense. Idiocy. The fact is that these migrants do not earn enough money to pay the taxes necessary to defray the cost of the social services provided to them, writes Tim Murray. In the case of Syrian migrants, it was found that after 1 year of residence, only 1 in 10, or just a little more than 1 in 10, 12%, had found employment. Oh, they're doing pretty well, aren't they? No, they're going to be permanent parasites. This is not a recipe for smooth integration, and it bodes ill for their Canadian-born children. Already, some 43% of second-generation visible minority youth in Canada feel themselves to be alienated victims. Oh, yeah, well then, send them back! Send them back! The myth of Canadian exceptionalism, of our having found the secret formula for ethnic and racial harmony, is wearing thin on the ground. The jury is in. Canada has a limited absorptive capacity. Cities like Vancouver are suffering from ethnic indigestion. Too many, too fast, and without the necessary resources to help them. Rather than fit into the nation, many newcomers are fitting into ethnic enclaves that have grown exponentially. Liberal commentators call this diversity, but others call it cultural fragmentation and emergent tribalism. The downstream costs are incalculable. public safety and security must exact the greatest toll. All of this is the bitter harvest of the infamous Singh, and that's S-I-N-G-H, decision, handed down by the Supreme Court of Canada in 1985. When our learned judges determined that the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms meant all persons, not just citizens, were entitled to full charter protection simply by having their feet planted on Canadian soil. Since then, illegal migrants are like the guests on Groucho Marx's You Bet Your Life. Say the magic words, I'm a refugee, and you win the prize. All they need to do is get here. That's it. And the easiest way to do that is walk through an unguarded border crossing. Presto, you're in. Getting you out, on the other hand, can take 3 to 5 years, assuming that you don't play hide-and-seek. The trouble with Canada's refugee system is that, as Margaret Thatcher would have said, eventually you run out of other people's money. The Canadian welfare state, or any welfare state, cannot survive the crushing burden that untold numbers of failed state migrants will place upon it. The late Nobel Prize, Peace Prize winner, economist Milton Friedman, was right. You can have the welfare state, or you can have open borders, but you can't have both. Unlimited generosity is not sustainable. In order to preempt a nativist backlash, the natives getting restless, Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale assured Canadians that crossing the border illegally was not an automatic free ticket to citizenship. But Goodale is disingenuous. He neglected to mention that Canada will not deport people to 12 designated countries and locations, mainly in Africa and the Middle East, unless they stand convicted of a crime or a human rights infraction or are deemed to be a security risk. According to the latest available data supplied by the Immigration and Refugee Board, almost 1 in 4 people who were allowed to make a claim in the first 9 months of 2016 were from these undeportable areas. Many of them are Somali claimants who make up the bulk of illegal border crossings in Emerson, Manitoba. They are the beneficiaries of what's known as an administrative deferral of removal. Temporary bans can be removed at any time, of course, but if recent history is any guide, these claimants will be allowed time to apply for permanent residency. All this proves asylum shopping works. Shop around, and you'll soon find out that Canada is an easy touch. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.